I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Midway in 2016, one of those years, like 1968, in which it seems everything that can happen is happening. This week, it's Brexit, a landmark in post-war Europe, a close but decisive choice by the voters of England to end the marriage with the European Union after 43 years. It wasn't supposed to come to this. And the family fallout is at the limits of remorse, anger, dread. Here's a taste of it from London, starting with the Tory Prime Minister, David Cameron, who called for the referendum, sure that it would go the other way. Then some of his parliamentary opposition.
The British people have voted to leave the European Union, and their will must be respected. I was absolutely clear about my belief that Britain is stronger, safer, and better off inside the European Union. But the British people have made a very clear decision to take a different path.
Isn't it funny? You know, when I came here 17 years ago and I said that I wanted to lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, you all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you? And the reason you're so angry has been perfectly clear. You, as a political project, are in denial.
Yesterday, a former member of my staff was verbally abused and attacked whilst out shopping in London because of the colour of his skin. He was chased down the road by a lady shouting about how he had voted out and that people like him shoot others and blow up people.
Shame.
There is a legitimate anger in places where people have been ignored for a very long time. They've been ignored by London, and now they're being sneered at for being angry as if they were, you know.
Okay.
And there are not, I just want to say one thing, there are not 17.4 million racists in this country, and that's absolutely important to say.
Okay.
One of the horrible disfigurements of our society is racism, is intolerance, and the violence that's often associated with it. And sadly, this has increased over the last few days. Can we all agree we are going to unite together as one people, one society, and one community to oppose racism in any form?
Jeff Dyer is our idea of the seriously funny Englishman at large. Travel writer and art critic, strong on D.H. Lawrence and American jazz. He's based now in Los Angeles, but he went home to get the sense of London on the street when it came to the Brexit vote.
Well, I'll certainly never forget the night of the referendum. It was one of these absolutely hellish London nights, which in retrospect seems suitably post-apocalyptic. It was very warm. It had been pouring with rain all day. And it was really sort of stormy, I mean, incredibly dark, you know, darkness visible in the Milton phrase. It was the sun was not shining. And as a result of all the rain and the floods, the transport in London was completely screwed. So everyone was in even more of a sort of funk than they normally are. And I was going to play in a little ping pong tournament at the Magnum Photo Agency. And I had to make my way over to East London. And life in London has shifted so far east, so there was this kind of terrible rain everywhere, but the sidewalks, the pavements were jammed with people boozing, which is always the case in London. And there was a real sense of this, in retrospect, as I say, of God, the scene could hardly have been more appropriate for what transpired. And streets were full of foreigners. I say that just as a term of description, not with anything pejorative about it. All these different languages spoken. You know, in many ways, that's what people find so exciting about London. You know, this kind of incredible melting pot of different people, all getting on okay, all sort of, you know, always with this simmering London or English kind of rage everywhere. But that was the scene on the referendum night.
And then comes the morning.
And then, the next morning, I think that was the incredible thing, the speed with which people thought, oh, my God, you know, what does this mean? What have I voted for? And there was such a look of panic, I think, of disbelief, as people said, even on the face of Johnson. People refer to him as Boris. My loathing for him is so complete. I can't bear to use his first name. That might suggest some sort of fondness for him. I really would say with some confidence, if the vote was then rerun because of some procedural irregularity and people had a chance to sort of consider the consequences, then I think we would have redone it and people would have more sensibly and rationally decided to stay in Europe, as opposed to doing what they did, which was to give expression to that very English feeling with which I'm all too familiar, of just feeling incredibly pissed off with everything.
Carla Power is an American author who grew up in St. Louis, a roving reporter on the cross-cultural conversations in the infinite diversity of London today.
What has come out is this light papering over of all sorts of fissures in British society. We thought we had a two-party system that worked. We thought there was a society there. And we thought that generations raised on EasyJet travel and on being part of something bigger post-empire would vote for that. And I think one of the shocks is recognizing how little listening had been going on and how distant London and Westminster had grown from everybody else. The elites knew that it was post-austerity. There were a lot of unhappy people, but I don't think they understood the extent of it when, for example, Gordon Brown said during the last election, when a lady came to him, he caught her saying, "These immigrants are coming and they're taking our jobs." And he was caught in his car going home saying, "Oh, she's just a racist." That has been the political elite's response to Britons who might not have been racist, but who were feeling squeezed and scared by immigration. There hasn't really been a well-digested debate about immigration in this country.
What is the British problem with immigrants? I mean, they're very global, sophisticated, worldly people. They invented globalism in a way. What's the problem?
For the past 3 or 4 years, there have been real cuts. We're watching the NHS, the National Health Service, which was set up after the war and has been the pride and joy of many Britons of a certain age. We're watching it being stretched to its limit. People are watching their schools get underfunded. They're watching their public services get strained. And instead of blaming the austerity measures imposed on them by the Conservative government, which has been vicious in its cuts, they've been encouraged to blame this influx of migrants. The joke being, of course, that the highest UKIP support for the anti-immigrant party was in places where there weren't migrants. London, where there are tons of migrants, was, of course, a very strong proponent of Remain. So I don't know that there's a real problem with migrants, but it's been allowed to be exploited. There is a strain of nostalgia that is running through right now, and the sense of if we could all go back to the time when, as John Major said, you know, there were old ladies bicycling through the rain on Sunday mornings to go to church. There's this kind of imaginary Britain that a certain strain of people who are very bewildered by globalization and who have lost out, let's face it.
Mark Blyth is a Scots-born political economist at Brown University, son of a butcher in Dundee, who always makes you feel you're listening to the best talker in a Glasgow pub.
When 80% of the people figure out that 80% of the time, the 20% that run everything have been selling them a bill of goods, eventually they're going to say, "Hang on a minute," and that's what just happened. This is no different from Trump. This is no different from the Le Pen in France. This is no different from the left-wing version, which is Syriza and Sinn Féin. People have been sold a bill of goods regarding globalization, Europeanization. Their wages are still the same, if not lower. Their jobs are less secure. They've been told to prepare themselves for robots coming down a turnpike. And meanwhile, the governing classes say this is the best of all possible worlds. Well, it's not. They've figured it out. They've called you on it. This isn't about the EU. This is about anger. It's about frustration. It's about a lack of representation. It's about technocracy.
Mark, in your book on austerity, which we read very carefully, you went so far as to say it was this kind of grinding down on people in debt, Germany to it, that sort of produced the monster of Hitler in the 30s. I mean, what are the risks here? particularly as the governing class doesn't seem to be getting it too much.
Well, that's always a danger when the governing class doesn't get it. But in Britain, we've got an even worse situation where the governing class has just collapsed. Hmm. There's no effective leadership. I mean, what type of prime minister in a moment of crisis for his country just goes, dude, I'm out of here, we'll figure it out by October, which is exactly what David Cameron has done. It's an absolute disgrace. So there's no effective leadership. You're in a global economy which is tilting into deflation. You have got a large part of the income distribution of the developed countries that have done not well at all or really, really badly for the past 15 years. And you have people like Trump promising them the moon, and they're going to deliver them, if they're lucky, green cheese. That doesn't end well. So if the British Parliament, who actually have to vote on this referendum, because only Parliament is sovereign, that's how Britain works, you're talking about leaving the EU so you can force the breakup of Britain. And if you do that, what happens to the nukes? What happens to NATO? What happens to the seat in the G7? What happens to the seat in the UN? This is way bigger stakes than anybody was bargaining for, because the upper classes and the ruling classes basically said it'll never happen. And the reason they thought that is because they only talk to each other.
How do we get at that problem, the blind and deaf governing class?
Think about it this way. When Bill Clinton was elected in 1992, there's a guy called Ross Perot who was saying all those, that giant sucking sound as all those jobs went to Mexico. He was right. There was meant to be all these compensations. People were going to be retrained. They were going to be reskilled. We were all going to end up computer programmers. Instead of which, we cut taxes on the rich and we deregulated everything, and those people were left to fend for themselves. The same thing happened with Tony Blair with New Labour. The same thing happened with Gerhard Schroeder, even in Germany. This is a global phenomenon. I don't blame the right for this. That's what the right does. That's what the right says. They're at least honest about it. It's the centre-left's complicity in this, which is truly shocking. But when Bill Clinton was elected in 1992, the phrase that I always remember him saying is, the new global economy. We're going to have to compete in the new global economy. If you actually look at how much of the United States is exposed to the global economy in 1982, it's less than 10% of the economy. This was always nonsense. This was a way of maximising shareholder value and returns to American corporations by basically squeezing labour in a way that they could never respond, because you can't strike when the job's been moved abroad. This has been decades in the making.
Coming up, two variations on post-Brexit chagrin with the magisterial historian Simon Sharma and the chastened prophet John Lanchester. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the dizzy aftermath of England's Brexit vote to leave Europe, the novelist of finance John Lanchester takes the view that the popular majority, those leave voters, were right about the problem but way wrong about the solution. Nobody has been harder on the money class that has come to rule England than John Lanchester. 4 years ago, he condemned what he called a parody of economic order, a monstrous socialism of the rich that sucks up all the rewards and eclipses democracy, he said. But he spoke to us this week sounding devastated that the voters appear to have taken his point as a sort of prophecy and acted on it.
It gives me no pleasure to say it is basically a victory for the prophecy, but there's a reason why, you know, the prophetess Cassandra was cursed. You know, it wasn't like, good for you, Cassandra. You know, you're going to be right about stuff and no one's going to listen to you. You know, that was perceived as a heavy curse. And the crucial part of the curse is the fact that no one listens. Hmm. I mean, you're right to say that people are saying no. You're right to say that people are saying stop. But I think it's more generalized and inchoate than a kind of specific thing. I think it's just a feeling of exclusion and alienation and left behindness. And we have a chance to actually, I tell you what, if we tick this box in this form, they're actually going to listen for once. And that's a powerful motor behind this, is the fact, you know, try ignoring this.
Speaking of alienation and left behindness, the New York Times has a fascinating piece this week from Sunderland, in coal country in England. We barely know it, a little bit through, I suppose, D.H. Lawrence or Orwell. But the poor coal folk of Sunderland voted out. Can you read that? Can you explain?
In fact, I was staying up to watch that because it was one of the first results that came through. It's one of the first constituencies to report. And that was the point at which I realized we were leaving. But that's when I went to bed, actually. I went to bed. My wife, it was about 1 o'clock. My wife said, you know, what's happened? And I said, we're leaving. At which point she then woke up, so I couldn't go back to sleep. One of the things that's interesting about Sunderland, by the way, is it has a gigantic Japanese-owned car factory there. The European headquarters of the Japanese car giant Nissan is in Sunderland, and they're based in the UK because it's useful to speak English, and then they manufacture the cars and sell them in Europe. It's also a city, it has this sort of deindustrializing post-coal history, but it also has a business that has a living, walking, talking, breathing argument for the economic advantages of being in the EU. So yeah, my read of it is that you just had an awful lot of people, notwithstanding the Nissan plant, feeling that they're stuck. I mean, I know Sunderland a little bit. It's a bit like parts of the Rust Belt in the United States, that the thing that used to happen there no longer does. The work that used to be there has gone, and the sense of purpose and community and belonging that came from that work, that's gone too. You know, the conventional thing used to be, well, you move somewhere else to work. The growth area in this country is in London and the southeast, and it's linked to finance. And a coal miner can't suddenly retrain and reinvent himself as a banker. And even if he tried to, he can't afford to move down here. And so there's that really strong geographical sense of stuckness and brokenness in huge swathes of the country. And one of the things about the vote, by the way, is it's very, very geographical. It's quite common to have people, you know, like in the street where I live in London, lots of the people around here work in finance. It could easily be the case. There's a couple of hundred people live in this street. It could easily be a case that there are no leavers in this street. And similarly, you have places where people who voted leave, but they wouldn't know any remainers. That's an unusual thing for the country to be so divided so profoundly along geographical and community lines. So I think that, you know, the sense of alienation and exclusion that people clearly do feel, I think in a way that's not a surprise. What came as more of a surprise was that they were willing to sort of override the economic case in order to voice it. So it is a surprise. I mean, cities are remain, towns are leave. The young are hugely remain, but they do this thing of that they do in the States as well, of not voting. You know, the turnout was something like 36%, and the turnout for people over 65 was 83%. That was a big part of it. And the countryside in general is leave, and Scotland, on the other hand, is remain, because the Scots, you know, like the EU and like the idea of identifying with something that isn't English.
John Lanchester, you've written wonderfully about the new architectural badges of the new London. What are the voters saying about them, the new London?
I think a huge part of this, Chris, is a sort of anti-London vote. People look around the country and they people sort of recognise each other, and then they look at the capital city and they don't recognise it. It doesn't represent them, they feel. And I think that's a huge, maybe even the single main underlying driver of the feelings that led to the Brexit vote.
John Lanchester, speak of those famous monuments of the new global rich as can be London, the Gherkin building, the cheese grater, the Shard. What did the voters say about them?
And don't forget the walkie-talkie as well. That's the one which has this very strange shape which concentrates light down in front of it so much that it melted a car.
So the Gherkin gets a no vote.
I mean, there's another point about those buildings that I think is interesting, is that they, you know, this whole idea of the icon building, the building that sort of is a statement about itself,
yes,
these very distinct, that one of the things about them is they don't care where they are. They aren't buildings that derive from a context or sense of place. They have no relationship with the space around them. They just sort of stand there and express, say, hey, look at me. I'm a Gherkin, I'm a Shard, whatever. And one of the things that that does is it is a sort of metaphor for the way that finance capitalism works, because the building doesn't care where it is and the money doesn't care where it is. It's not about the place it is. It's hot money. It's international money. It has no connection or relationship with the environment around it. And I think the architecture actually, consciously or not, expresses that in a very complete way. Those buildings don't care where they are, and the hot money inside them doesn't care where it is either.
John Lanchester, play Dickens again, and the special correspondent for Posterity. How long will it take for England, for the world, for everybody, to remember this moment as the time when the people said no to global financial capitalism, and it changed the world in some fashion? Give us the long context, if you can dream it up, the novelist in you.
I think that it really all depends on what happens in Europe because I think this could well be the straw in the wind and the first sign of a kind of reconfiguring of the way Europe functions. And I think there's a chance that this sort of moment could turn into a thing, well, hang on a minute, let's not go any further down this route. Let's be fairer, happier, more prosperous, healthier, longer lived, instead of just a place where the rich people keep getting richer every year. I'm not especially optimistic about that, because I think that there are some very dark forces at work here as well, that, you know, the route to more inclusive and fairer societies historically is not through nationalist backlashes of this sort. And I think that in the short term, you know, what we're going to see is loud demands all across the continent of Europe from right-wing parties who say, hang on a minute, how come only the British get to decide?
Right.
And by the way, we're sick of immigrants too. And by the way, we feel our culture is being diluted too. And so where's our referendum vote? And it's happened quite fast here that there's a reported upsurge already in xenophobic incidents, racist incidents, people having comments in the street. And I think, you know, a lot of modern societies have those things not very far beneath the surface. And the Leave thing has given some people with very dark ideas permission to feel that they're in the right. So I think that the positive, optimistic reality check, is this who we want to be argument, it has a very strong countercurrent. There's a reason that these particular genies have been firmly locked up in the bottle for all these years.
John Lanchester covers money matters in the London Review of Books. His social novel about England and his own London neighborhood in the age of finance was titled Capital. Simon Sharma is a British-born historian on the grand scale, beyond shock or surprise, you'd have said, chronicler of the French Revolution, the Dutch Renaissance, the Jewish people. But from London this week, he too sounded mortified by England's rejection of Europe. A possibly irreversible setback, he said, to possibly the happiest big development of his lifetime.
We, you know, those of us who kind of grew up in the 60s and went on to see the transformation of Britain and its big cities in particular, not just London, but Manchester and Leeds and Glasgow and Edinburgh, all of which voted to remain, by the way, wasn't just London. We were just sort of too complacent, really, about assuming this little England mind, this kind of mind that was sort of seething with resentment against the modern world, was still around. So what I think has really brought it back to this shocking victory, really, are two kind of functionally unrelated phenomena. The first are the extremely unequal distribution of benefits from the recovery
right
after the crash of 2008. Same thing as in America. And all of my wonderful American friends who are worrying that Trump will get some traction from the slipstream, mixing my metaphors there, are quite right about this. The problem is that the unequal distribution of rewards from the recovery is happening at the same time as a great wash of human migration. It's happening much more extremely in Europe, for obvious reasons, than it is in the United States. But the ability to connect these two completely objectively unconnected phenomena is called demagoguery. And that's what's happened.
Simon, put your stethoscope to the heart of this European project, which we are all falling in love with in a way. Maybe the biggest good thing that happened in our lifetime. Not only no more war in Europe, but
yeah,
the idea of a mobile and shared prosperity. I mean,
right.
What now? And how grave the damage?
I'm laughing because you're the same age and the same sentimental opinion as me. Thank God for that. You're quite right, of course. And it begins with, you know, out of the ashes of war. I was born before the war ended, just in 1945. But, you know, even though we grew up, not very long after the war, the kind of sense of what the reconciliation of France and Germany meant when compounded by American engagement embodied by the Marshall Plan was really, really profound. And, you know, putting on my history professor's hat, of course, it is an absolutely astonishing thing that an upheaval so tumultuous as the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the unification of Germany could actually be absorbed by the extraordinary kind of shock absorber that is the European Union. That said, what the European Union has not done very well has actually to produce a kind of impassioned defense of itself, which is something more than managing the business cycle. That was a terrible, damaging fault of the Remain campaign in Britain, and it's a fault more generally of those in charge of the European project. Those of us who love it and want it to succeed and now desperate that it should not fail, you know, we're really sort of disappointed to just see the whole kind of raison d'etre of the European Union be presented as I say, sort of management of the economic cycle rather than something bigger. What ought to happen now, in my view, is some sort of, you know, very grand European constitutional convention, I mean, of the kind which founded the American Republic. That needs to be rethought in fundamentals. There are kind of small, dull, grey, tinkering ways in which the whole sense of what the European Union could be and how democratic it can be revised and need revision desperately.
Simon, speak to that other view, though. And I must say that the simplicity of the map of the voting in England, it's London basically against the country. And the simplicity of Bernie Sanders' op-ed in the Times this week, in which he said, it's really very simple. British workers are turning their backs, not on strange people, but on a global economy that is failing them and their children.
No, that's just completely not true. That's sort of sentimental socialist. First of all, it's not true in two very important respects. Many working class cities voted strongly to remain. Glasgow is a working class city. Manchester is a working class city. Liverpool, by God, is a working class city. I'll tell you what, Christopher, the more immigrants you have in your working class city, the more likely you were to vote remain.
That was so fascinating. Yeah.
So that is something. So Bernie Sanders is simply not doing his homework properly, and he's just simply draping it in the rhetoric of his own kind of universalist socialist, you know, wishful thinking. Secondly, he doesn't want to imagine that working class people can be racists, but many of them are. Upper class people can be racist. Middle class people can be racist too. This was a decision driven viscerally by immigration and overwhelmingly by immigration.
There is another strong view, though, and it's not just Bernie. A lot of Brits, too, that we've talked to, who feel it's not racism, it's left-behindism, a sense that they've been dealt out.
What happened is that a legitimate sense of being left out by the recovery, the unequal distribution of rewards, has been laid at the door of immigrants. I mean, if you put the case, and the case was put, it may not have been put very well, but if the case was put that actually leaving the EU is actually going to make whatever trouble you might be in worse, but maybe you hate the idea of immigrants so much that you don't care, the vast majority of people will say, yeah, I think you're right, we don't care. We don't care. Otherwise, how do you explain Sunderland, for example,
right,
which had a gigantic Leave vote,
right,
but actually is in peril now? It builds Nissan cars, but Nissan cars that have to be sold into Europe. So you have the danger, not immediately, but down the line, Nissan will undoubtedly move its factory somewhere else where it can sell into Europe. But nobody really cared. They thought, well, we'll deal with that when it happens, because they were so steamed up about having Britain taken away from them. The phrase take back control is entirely about taking control of the borders. It's not about social democracy. Dream on, Bernie.
Okay. Simon, put your stethoscope back on the heart of this Europe idea. What's the damage? What's the prospect, do you think?
Well, I think it's very grim. I think it's very grim, not just because of what's happened in Britain, but it was no accident that it was celebrated by Marine Le Pen and by Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. And that division between actually a kind of universalist or transnational idea of moving forward together and countries shrinking into their own combative, tribal, viscerally driven sense of us against the foreigner, that can be seen really happening all over Europe. There's almost nowhere it isn't happening. So the European idea has its back against the wall. It needs really powerful and impassioned spokesmen, or it's done for, I think. You know, hello 1930s, where the only thing that was any good were Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire.
Bernie Sanders was addressing the Democratic Party, saying, get your act together or this wave is breaking here next. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think he has a point there. I do think Bernie has a point there. I think this issue of social injustice, or the sense of social injustice, is smouldering there. I think still, and, you know, we'll see what plays out in our election. If Donald Trump, who's already started to blame it on, I don't know, Mexican immigrants and the Chinese, so he's banging exactly the same drum as the Brexiters. So it's going to be incumbent on the Democratic nominee. I mean, it can't have, you know, her attention has been paid to this, but she has to sound, it's tricky for her, because she has to sound attentive to the legitimate grievances of people who feel left behind in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, where the election will be won or lost. At the same time, she realizes the kind of adrenaline rush appeal of Donald Trump's finger pointing and scapegoating. This is the year of successful scapegoating. So it's tricky, because she has to pay a lot of attention to that without alienating the Republican middle, who will be inclined either to vote for her or sit on their hands. So that is a very fine measurement, but and that will be the first great test of her true political skills, I think.
Simon Chama wrote and hosted the BBC's History of Britain. He teaches history and art history at Columbia University in New York. Coming up, the eerie resonances of the Brexit split in and around our own American presidential choice in 2016. This is Open Source. What makes Brexit so fascinating to Americans, of course, as Simon Chama noted at the end, are all the common terms and arguable connections with our own political scene in this summer and fall of 2016. So this is the moment in our hour to get very particular about what is similar, what is different, and whether there really is a spirit of the age that encompasses the whole thing. With us in studio, Alex Gurevich is a political economist at Brown, a writer at Salon.com and Jacobin magazine. Arthur Goldhammer at Harvard's Center for European Studies is the go-to translator into English of the continent's most important writers, from de Tocqueville to Thomas Piketty and his Modern Studies of Capitalism and Inequality. So, Europe and the U.S., gentlemen, issues of money power in a democracy, risks of anger, social anger, demagoguery. I've got a checklist of points on which you could argue the links in our conversation in Europe. But first, a general crack from the two of you at the question, more like than different, U.S. and Europe, or different than like? Alex first, then Arthur, please.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here. I would say the most important way in which they are like is that people see the Brexit vote in England or in the UK and the rise of Trump here as a sign that there's too much democracy. And I think that's a really deep mistake, that I think it's a sign of too much anti-democracy, too much hostility to actually sort of developing properly democratic institutions and democratic parties. And for all the differences that we can identify, I think the real problem is that not just that there's sort of overall undemocratic developments, but in particular something that Mark Blythe mentioned, which is that the center-left's complicity in preferring to develop some kind of technocratic expert rule and thinking that these technocrats plus a bunch of sort of counter-majoritarian institutions can protect us from the people. And I think it's actually when we start thinking that way and organizing our politics that way that we just seed the field to right-wing populists, because then they end up being the only people who can sound like they're true Democrats.
And are the people out of control? Do we have to do something? Can we blame the people? We argued this with Andrew Sullivan a few weeks ago on this very program.
Yeah.
And this week, it's an astonishing piece by James Traub. We used to reading him in the Times magazine. Under the headline, "It's time for the elites to rise up against the ignorant masses." And you think he's kidding, but he's not. He says the Brexit has laid bare the political schism of our time. It's not about left versus the right. It's about the sane versus the mindlessly angry. So there's the whole question of the, you know, the wisdom of crowds, but not these crowds. Arthur, generally, like or different?
I see many great similarities between Europe and the United States, and then one big difference. The great similarities have already been touched on. Alex mentioned one of them, which is the issue of technocratic rule and counter-majoritarian institutions. However, I'd like to complicate that picture a little bit by saying that technocracy itself is divided. There are technocrats who take different positions on what the economic, the central economic problem of our time is. I think it's true that the EU has evolved in a way that has privileged decision-making by technocratic elites who are not accountable and do not have to explain themselves in elaborate ways to the people. But in many ways, the Brexit vote was a revolt about what's best in European technocracy and not about what's worst. European technocracy has tried to rein in some of the excesses of a free market economy. It's tried to impose regulations that are necessary for a social democratic future of the kind that Alex and I agree would be preferable to the rain of money that we have now. But
I was just going to say, if I may, Arthur, isn't technocracy a kind of polite word for a plutocracy? The fact that this system, it's not just that the bureaucrats are controlled, but that the benefits are going up, up, up.
No, I don't think so. I think that the technocrats, in a way, are a check on the plutocrats. The elites themselves can be divided into political elites and technocratic elites. In the case of Britain, Britain was not constrained by the EU technocracy in the way that members of the Eurozone are, for example. It has its own currency. It could have broken with austerity, which Mark Blythe puts at the top of the EU's problems. Britain did not have to follow the austerity rule. It was Britain's political elites and not its technocratic elites which made that choice. And the irony of the Brexit vote is that Brexit was carried by a Tory faction, the Tories being the party that imposed austerity on Britain. So the British voters who were voting to throw off EU technocracy were voting to bring back or to reinforce the austerity that they had, their own political elite had imposed on themselves. Boris Johnson said the issue was not immigration but control, and yet the British voters attempting to reassert control were merely reinforcing the Tory rule that has brought them the austerity they're complaining about.
Alex, quickly.
Yeah, quickly. I mean, just two points. One, where I disagree with Art is that I don't see the EU as functioning in any way to kind of create the conditions for protecting social democracy from the market. I mean, all of the negotiations with Greece show that it's in the grips of this sort of sado-monetarist, bizarre kind of use of its monetary and fiscal power to impose even more kind of horrific forms of austerity on governments that actively rejected it. And in the least democratic ways, right? I mean, they imposed two governments on Italy and Greece during the euro crisis.
Glad you mentioned Greece. You know, do we understand in this country how undemocratic and anti-democratic are the dimensions of life in Europe today? The foreign minister, when the bankers crushed Greece a year ago, Yanis Varoufakis, says we have an email democracy in Greece now. We get an 11,000-page document from the bankers in Frankfurt or Berlin telling us, here's what you're going to do. It's not a pretty story. Similarly, in Portugal, how did the troika of bankers in Ireland also come to be the government of those smart, old, interesting places?
Greece, in my view, was an exception, which unfortunately has been taken as a paradigm of EU, of the functioning of the EU. I don't think it was the case for a variety of reasons that we don't have time to go into here that we've discussed on a previous program of yours. Greece is different, and I don't think that Greece should be taken as typical of the way that the EU has functioned in the past. It might become typical of the way that the EU functions in the future. Unfortunately, that's what has to be fought against. But I don't. I can't agree with Alex that this is that the EU is essentially an oligarchic plutocratic institution. That's just.
But
not
this
the way
might
I
be
see
the
it.
Moment to celebrate the difference in this country. There's an English American government professor at Harvard, Richard Tuck, who made a sharp point to us this week that we have it wonderfully here in the United States, where Bernie Sanders, for example, can run for president, say, elect me, and we will renegotiate the NAFTA rules, we will tax Wall Street, and every kid in America will get a free college education. Vote me up or down, but it can be done. He was saying you couldn't run on a platform like that in a country in the European Union.
I mean, I understand why Richard says that, and I think he's certainly right that there are aspects of the what is effectively the constitution of the EU that makes it impossible to engage in various kinds of social
single-state initiatives. Yeah,
single-state initiatives, the four freedoms enshrined in the constitution, for instance. I mean, one of the difficult things about the EU is that you get into the weeds of these really obscure-sounding things, but one of the basic four freedoms basically now means that you can't exercise a right to strike to prevent your jobs from going to another country because it's taken to violate freedom of movement of persons because corporations are seen as persons. And that's something imposed on all the states by the European Court of Justice. But where I don't think it's just a problem of the constraint of the EU is that at the end of the day, and here's actually sort of an agreement between me and Art, what matters is that the EU is just a way in which national politicians do politics, right? At the end of the day, most of the power is still in the hands of these nation states, but the national elites prefer to make all the decisions in the arenas of the EU, where they don't have to explain themselves, where they don't have to make the case for the legislation. And this was the lie of the right-wing lever argument, because it wasn't enough to have democracy just to say we don't want the EU. You have to actually believe in democratic rule, and I don't think any of the Tories ever did.
Agree or disagree, Arthur?
That is a point of agreement between me and Alex. What I think is neglected in the argument that Mark Blyth makes, and that perhaps Alex shares to some degree, is that it neglects the power of the forces coming from the globalization of the economy. All politicians of the left or right, whatever their political stripe, have to respond to these external economic forces in some way. Mark Blyth said the changes were introduced in U.S. governance, we were not feeling the pressure from outside. But that neglects, for example, the competition already coming in the 1980s from Japanese automobile companies. The reason there is such resentment in the Rust Belt in the United States is that jobs that were protected, that were being paid efficiency wages above and beyond the market wage, because auto companies could afford to do so because they were in monopoly control, were threatened by the competition coming from lower wage countries. That competition has increased and multiplied over the past two decades. And it's those pressures that are being responded to by the European technocracy in ways that one can see as furtherance of social democratic politics that could not be pursued at the national level, that requires a larger scale in order to compete effectively.
Here's another point where I wish you'd tear and compare, and that is the shadow of the 30s, of Weimar, of, to be blunt about it, Hitler, the danger of something really cataclysmic in the works here. Over there, over here, is it real? Is it a mask for, again, putting down the people of simply not wanting to listen, or what?
Well, I worry a great deal about the dangers of nationalism, and that's in some ways the source of my sentimental attachment to the EU. I woke up on the morning after Brexit feeling that I was much more of a European patriot than I was the day before. The day before, I recognized and took on board all of the criticisms that Alex and Mark Blyth and John Lanchester and your other guests are making. But the importance of preserving the EU as an institution that is capable of combating nationalism, the dangers of nationalism that we saw in the 1930s, I think is an important one. And that's why I would like to preserve it. I think it is threatened by Brexit, and I hope that Brexit will galvanize what has been an anemic effort to redemocratize the EU and Europe.
Your turn, Alex.
Yeah, I don't see shades of the 30s at all here, actually. I mean, people promised before the vote, oh, well, if they leave, we're going to have this sort of red tide of racist hatred. There's going to be all kinds of racist violence all over. We're going to have street fighting by the nationalist yobs. There have been certainly isolated incidents, but actually much less than what everybody seemed to be predicting. And moreover, the difference between now and the 30s and the 30s, you had not just many more people. You had 35% of the population of Germany in election 32 voting for the socialists or the communists. But what it meant to vote for a socialist communist there was much more radical. You had street fighting among sort of, you know, the communists and the fascists. You had a much more extensive breakdown of the state. I think this gets kind of trotted out to try to whip people in line and not demand more democracy, because if you demand more democracy, well, then, you know, what you want to do is bring us back to the kind of scary days of when the Nazis...
Interesting argument. Doesn't it come down really to a question of how you weigh economics and identity issues as political motivators? Whether people are responding to xenophobia or nationalism or this or race or immigration spurs, or fundamentally to the fact or to the feeling that they're getting screwed economically, they're being dealt out, and that they can feel it in the household budget.
Well, I think people search for their identities in different places, and globalization has made it possible for a part of the population to take on a more cosmopolitan identity than was possible in the past. For some of us, that's a source of liberation. It's something that we are attracted to. And you saw that in the youth vote in England. Young people in Britain found themselves free to travel, to vacation, to study abroad, to plan their futures abroad. And they responded positively to that. But that's not true for everyone. Not everyone sees themselves, not everyone feels that attraction of the foreign. Not everyone sees it as a liberation. Some feel it as a threat. So you have divisions being created within countries as a result of new economic possibilities. And therefore, I don't see economy and identity as divorced. I see them as closely intertwined.
Let me get in one more checklist question. And it's this pattern of British and American politics. Margaret Thatcher preceded Ronald Reagan. They gave us neoliberalism. You know, Bill Clinton preceded Tony Blair. They gave us triangulation, sort of the elimination of the left opposition. Today, there's some sort of connection or parallel or between Hillary and Clinton. I mean, and Cameron, or between Boris Johnson and Trump. But what's real, what's not? Or is it all one big game under one big umbrella?
I mean, it's not clear to me, you know, how strong those analogies are. I mean, the most interesting thing to me from this side of politics is how much more comfortable the kind of neoliberals are in running against a right-wing populist than an actual challenge from the left. From the beginning of the Bernie Sanders campaign, they wanted to make him disappear. And that is also what's happening in labor. I mean, this little kind of mini coup against Corbyn. They're just sort of the Blairites and neoliberals are just much more comfortable presenting the political situation as if our only options are right-wing nationalists and the kind of neoliberal rule by experts. I also cannot resist making one more point on the previous question you asked, Art, which is, you know, when Seemon Sharma decided to don his little headmaster kind of hat and finger wag and say, oh, the working class actually didn't vote for Leave, and that Sanders should have done his homework. That's just not true. He didn't do his homework. The working class voted to a very large majority of the working class vote was for Leave. And the primary reason they gave was not because of immigration, but because they were concerned about democracy. So this isn't just about economics and identity, but about democratic control.
We're left with the feeling, surely, that the planets are aligning in some very strange ways here, especially when Iceland beats England at their national sport. You know, somebody's trying to deliver a big message here. Thank you, Alex Gurevich and Arthur Goldhammer, forgive me. Thanks also to Jeff Dyer, Carla Power, Mark Blythe, John Lanchester, and Simon Chama. Thanks also to Richard Tuck. You can hear longer versions of our conversations with these folks on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Home Secretary. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.